My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pahl and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into round one, which tests their vocabulary. For two marks, what is the dictionary meaning of these words? Frank Muir, loblolly or loblolly, L-O-B-L-O-L-L-Y.
It sounds like a peculiarly sticky version of a water ice on a stick sold to children to throw over the gallery at cinemas.
Yes.
I gather it isn't, though.
No, edible.
Barely edible.
It's navel. It's a navel connotation.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a stew or something?
Yes, that's more like it, yeah.
But it's thick, whatever it is, mm-hmm. Hence lob. And it's rather nasty and huge and thick and primitive and 18th century and yuck.
Two marks. It's a thick porridge or gruel, once used to be served to sailors, a sort of mush of spoon meat. It is also a country lout, and it seems to me very improbable. In the United States, lob lolly is a puddle. I don't know why at all. Two marks. Anne Scott James, a lipogram or lipogram, L-I-P-O-G-R-A-M, and again, I'm not certain on which syllable the action should be, the dictionaries differ.
Well, it must be something to do with letters.
It is.
With writing. And the obvious thing is to think it's something to do with lips or lip reading, but it obviously isn't. You said lipogram.
I would prefer it that way, though most people say lipogram, and because there is a Greek verb called lipine behind it.
Oh, that makes a difference. It means to leave something out.
Yes.
So if you leave out some letters and you're writing in a sort of rather stuffy period, and say 1860, and you want to say dash or
yes.
Damn, you put D and three asterisks. Would that be a lipogram?
I think it would. It's a composition, usually in verse, but not always, from which all the words that contain a certain letter or letters are omitted. I think Anne's example is a perfectly good one. Two marks. Dennis Norden, a caucus.
Now this comes up in all reports of American presidential elections. There's always a caucus in a smoke-filled room. And they move about from room to room. I never quite know what it means, actually. I think it's a kind of hardcore of a ginger group or a dissident group who exert pressure and influence.
That's absolutely right, Dennis. A meeting of members, usually of a political party, and originally in the United States, as Dennis says, it's to nominate candidates or decide how to vote on any particular question. Once they've made that decision, they wanted to vote that way. It was transferred over into Britain, and it means any much too influential small group which is managing an election or almost managing anything at all. Two marks. Dennis Powell, a pratfall.
Well, the last time I took my dog for a walk in the park, and he saw a bicyclist, and he doesn't like bicyclists, and he pulled very sharply on the lead, and I performed a pratfall.
Did you go forwards or backwards?
Backwards, yeah. In fact, you fall on your bum.
That's exactly right. Quite right. It's a I'm not suggesting you are a comedian, Dillis, but it is a comedian's comic fall onto the buttocks in burlesque or music hall, usually signalized with a loud thump on a drum. It also can be any kind of humiliating experience, and nobody knows much how it came to mean that, except that prat is slang for the buttocks. Nobody knows why. Two marks. Well, now for those who like to guess ahead at the stories, we'd be glad to have Frank Muir's quotation for later on in the program.
My quotation comes from a piece by Robert Louis Stevenson, a penny plain and tuppence coloured.
A penny plain and tuppence coloured. Well, yours, Dennis?
Mine's from Tennyson. 'Tis better to have loved and lost.
Well, that gives you a choice. We go on to round two, origins and derivations. For 2 marks, how did the following words or phrases originate, or from what did they derive? And Frank Muir, yours is a white elephant.
It means now something which is too large or ugly or expensive to be other than a liability.
Yes. And originally, how did it originate?
How does Siam grab you?
Yes, absolutely right. Grabs me well.
It was the king of they treated elephants rather differently from we do. We didn't cage them up and look at them. They worked them in the forests, and the white elephants the king thought were very good, and I think they had some kind of special status.
Yes.
And then myth has it. Hath it not, myth, that if the king wanted to beggar somebody he didn't like, he'd give them one of these rather royal and hungry animals as a present, and then the chap who received it had to maintain it, and he was therefore destroyed financially.
Absolutely right,
mate. All these Siamese.
And Scott James, to take someone down a peg or two.
Well, before chalks and blackboards were used for scoring for games, in, let us say, sort of from sort of 1600-ish, they scored with pegs in holes.
Like cribbage.
Exactly.
If a thing has got strings, it also normally has pegs.
Ah, stringed instruments.
Yes.
In which, by tightening your strings, you make the sound higher, do you not?
Yes.
And you make it lower if you loosen them.
Yes.
Loosen your pegs to which the strings are attached. Mm.
In fact, this is a rather signal that the person is inferior. Is it right?
Yep. That is a leap in logic, which doesn't follow from loosening the peg of a musical instrument.
I'd improve it if it was overtaught.
You say, I'll loosen his peg a bit. that merely transposes him into another.
But on the other hand, supposing you look across the garden fence and you find that the lady across her fence and her clothesline, her linens are whiter than yours. Whiter than white.
Oh, yes.
I feel...
You take down a couple of the pegs so that they
fall. Yes. Three versions, Jack.
I think we may be on the track of something.
Yes,
here,
I think you're on the track, so yes. I don't think they use pigs. I think they use chicken wishbones or something at that stage. Anyway, I think you get your 2 marks. The practice of lowering the tone of a string musical instrument by using a string from a lower peg. There is another explanation, too, and this is even less clear to me. That's a ship's colours, which used to be raised or lowered by pegs, so that the higher you raised the colours, the greater the honour you were doing to whoever it was, and to take them down a peg would be to award them much less honour. But I think you get your 2 marks.
Nautical rubbish.
Well, I don't know if there's an admiral in the audience. Might be able to find out. Anyway, Dennis Norton, your turn.
No longer.
Cooey. Well, I would think it's a natural sound to make to attract attention.
But where first made?
Oh, well, it's like corroboree, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
It was made in Australia somewhere.
Yes, and to do what? Why did they do it?
Well, there wasn't much else to do.
In Australia at that time. Push to push.
That's it. They used to sort of spend their time attracting each other's attention by shouting cooey across vast distances of the interior.
That's absolutely right.
This is well a good way of passing time. Then they learnt cricket.
It's a signal call used by Australian Aborigines to locate each other or to attract attention. I believe the ooh part ought to be 6 to 8 times as long as the E, which I didn't do very well. But it should finish on an upward note. Now, I'm not going to do that because I should break the microphone if I try. But 2 marks. Let us bow a cockney.
A Cockney? Mm-hmm. What it means, or...
What it comes from.
It means an inhabitant of London, and it comes from, I think, the word cocaine.
Mm.
Supposed to be one born within sound of bow bells.
Mm.
But it derives from the Middle English cockani, which means a cock's egg, which is a misshapen small egg, probably without a yolk, and therefore a rather foolish child or a foolish person. This is a countryman's idea of what people who lived in London were like. That is, they knew nothing about anything important at all and were pretty useless because they didn't know how to live as you live in the country. We have now a quick round of basic ingredients, and for 2 marks, I want to know what is the basic ingredient, there are others, of course, the basic ingredient of the following national foods or dishes. Frank Muir, Fu Yong Hai, H-A-I, Fu Yong Hai.
Well, the basic ingredient of Fu Yong Lo is a failed souffle.
You're in the right country, yes, that's right.
It's Chinese.
Yes.
There's an egg Fu Yong, isn't there?
Yes.
So egg Fu Yong Hai,
yes,
is an omelette made from those eggs which the Chinese bury for 100 years.
I wouldn't know the least about that, but you're quite right that it is the principal ingredient in this, which is a kind of Chinese omelette. It has usually also prawns, leeks, and celery. 2 months.
Thank you.
And Scott James, a Roquefort cheese.
Chief ingredient?
Chief ingredient.
Cream, I think.
Yes, but where from?
Roquefort.
No, I don't mean geographically.
Oh, it's a goat's cheese,
yeah.
I think. Isn't it?
No, it's sheep.
Of course it is. It's
well,
a sheep's cheese. Yes,
yeah,
quite right.
And what do you call that kind of sheep?
A milking sheep, a ewe.
That's what I wanted. Principal ingredient is ewe's milk. It used once upon a time to come from the town of Roquefort in France, but now I think one of the principal producing countries, in fact, is Corsica.
Yeah, yeah.
2 months.
Yes.
We go on to Dennis Norden, and yours are blinis, B-L-I-N-I-S.
Well, that's sort of Russian.
And
they're like pancakes, and you have caviar inside them if you're lucky.
Sour cream too.
But the principal ingredient,
toffees. Principal ingredient. What's the principal ingredient of pancakes?
Well, flour made from flour and milk.
Flour and milk.
Yes. They're made, I'm told, of buckwheat flour, with yeast and milk and eggs, and as Dennis says, if you're lucky, some caviar too. 2 months. Tillispau, Bombay duck.
Bombay duck is a kind of biscuit, isn't it?
Not
kind of thing you eat. Dried fish, sorry. Beg your pardon. It looks like a biscuit, but actually it does.
Thank you. Very easily fooled.
It looks like a very, very large piece of potato, a potato chip.
I think I'm going to give you a mark. You don't happen to know the name of the fish?
Charlie.
I can't win. It's dried, salted, and in my experience, pretty high fish. And the fish is, in fact, the bumalo, which is a small Indian fish, which comes, I'm told, from the same family as the salmon, very, very, very much smaller. And it doesn't have anything to do with Bombay at all. It's a Marathi word, bombil, which is what that fish is called. 2 months. Well, now we come to the last round, and to Frank and Dennis's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. Frank, your quotation, A Penny Plain and Tuppence Coloured.
After doing programmes like this for so many years, hardly 5 years goes by without a woman's magazine ringing up and asking Dennis or me if we ever had an embarrassing experience. Now, I had one. I had to go for quite a long drive. My wife said she wanted a shampoo with lanolin. So I said, where does that come from? And she said, it comes from wool. So I said, are you sure? And she said, yes. Everybody knows that. It comes from wool. So I said, right, I'll get you some. Well, I don't know if you know wool, but it's in Dorset. And it's, it's a town on the railway, but it's in between Poole Harbour and Dorchester. And so I drove down there to wool and bought this lanolin shampoo in a chemist. And it was 4 o'clock in the morning by the time I got back. And do you know Lime Lane?
near Chertsey, which is just before you come to Thorpe, where I live. Well, on the right-hand side, looking from Thorpe, is a gateway which leads on to a rubbish dump where you dump mattresses and mothers-in-law and things you don't. On the left is another gateway which is a sewage farm. And I was coming, as it happened, from the other direction, from Wall, at 4 o'clock in the morning, and my lights went wonky. So I pulled in to the right, where the rubbish dump was, and of course I was facing the other direction. It was actually the sewage farm. And I got out and fell into something, and I was soaked from head to foot. What to do? 4 o'clock in the morning. Now, I remembered at Virginia Water, which is only about three quarters of a mile away, there's an all-night dry cleaning place, an automatic one. Rushed there in the car, nobody there, lights full on. Got out of the car, driving in the dark was no fun. Got out of the car, rushed into this place, suddenly got crafty, because I was soaked right through with this stuff. And I put all the lights out in the shop, and stripped naked, apart from my suede shoes. The socks went in and everything into this dry cleaning thing, shoved it in, banged the door, shoved my coins in, banged the door shut, and waited, I thought, 20 minutes. And suddenly the lights on my car came on by themselves. And I was on headlights when they'd gone wrong. And there I was, and I thought the police might come. So I thought, maybe if I slip out and switch them off, if I did it swiftly. So I slipped out of the door, switched the lights off, went back, and the door wouldn't open. Because of the catch. So I thought, oh, what now? And it was really quite cold. You know? It wasn't at all pleasant. And the salient features were very unhappy. And suddenly a car came along, and I ducked down and tried to make a noise like a small hawthorn bush. And the car went along to almost the end shop. And I thought, of course it's for bakers. And bakers always start early in the morning. Nipped in, crouched in the shop, waited there a couple of minutes. Baker, obviously, stoked up his furnace, going home for a quick cup of tea before the slammed the door, locked it. And there I was in the baker shop, but I was safe and it was warm, albeit rather dark. And I was all right for a while. And I thought, I must think, what do I do in the morning? What do I do? Neat, but for me Swedes. Hanging up were some pinafores which the ladies who work in the shop wear, sort of plain blue. So I thought, if I put one of those on, scrape my hair forward, I could pretend to be one of those girls who plays like Liberace on the cash register at the supermarket, which is three doors up. So when they unlock in the morning, I could say, excuse me, I must go to work, and prance past. So I affected to be a woman by reddening my lips with some strawberry jam from a tartlet, which was on one of the shelves, so that I had nice bee-stung lips. And I thought I didn't look really terribly feminine, and also the pinafore didn't really quite meet at the back. But I thought the figure isn't right, so I wandered the shelves in this darkness with but a fitful moon illuminating it. And they had a row of sticky buns there. Do you know those buns with sort of sticky stuff, coloured sticky stuff on top of them, pink stuff? And I got a couple of these buns, and I found they stuck to my chest. if I bashed them on, sticky stuff downwards. And those under the pinafore really gave me the shape I needed. Well, I was a bit tired, I suppose, having driven out from Wool and whatnot. Because when I woke up, it was 11:45 on the Saturday morning. The shop was full of ladies buying bread. So I thought the only thing to do is to brave it. So I got up, said, must get back to my till, and minced out, clutching the fissure at the back where the pinafore didn't quite meet behind me. I eventually made the car and got home. Pretty embarrassing, but I thought I got away with it. Until the summons came. What I'd forgotten, of course, was that to make my escape, I'd had to steal from the shop. Well, you've probably guessed what I stole. The words on the summons just stare out at me even now, really like a line from a piece by Robert Louis Stevenson. A penny plain and two buns coloured.
And I remember the quotation Dennis Norden gave us was, "'Tis better to have loved and lost."
If this story has any purpose, it's to expose one of the most dangerous statements ever committed to print. If you have little or no talent for do-it-yourself, it says in this book called Handy Home Repairs, your best course is to begin in the smallest room in the house, such as the loo. Now, it's my contention that the first half of that statement makes absolute nonsense of the second half. If you have little or no talent for do-it-yourself, now that is me. So, to instruct someone like that, that the place where his handyman efforts can do the least harm is the loo. Well, it's like somebody telling Noah that the weather's likely to be scattered showers. In the first place, you see, our loo is not a room at all. It's in the bathroom. And more than that, it's in an extremely awkward position in the bathroom. Now, I don't know whether the builder who installed it was working from the same book that I was reading, but he placed it at such an angle that it faced the wall, which meant that whenever you used it, it was practically impossible to relax. You had the feeling that anything accomplished there was never quite definite. So that was the first item on my handyman brief: change position of loo. Second item: repaint ceiling black in place of existing colour, white with pink polka dots. Well, it was actually just plain white when we moved in. The polka dot pattern dated from the day I was gargling with pink mouthwash and found one of the kids had left a tadpole in the glass. Now, third item, replace bathroom door. Reason for that was the top half was that frosted glass stuff they used to have in old bathroom doors, and 2 days after our Swedish au pair girl arrived, my son and two friends were caught with a steam iron trying to smooth out the ripples. So that was the brief on which, according to this book, my minimal handyman abilities could do least harm. All right. Let me check out the finished work, taking the three items in ascending order of difficulty. Replace bathroom door, a technological doddle. Now, item two, repainting the ceiling shiny black. Yes, that done. Finished. Achieved. Now, the final item, reposition the loo. Now, oddly enough, I had no trouble with the plumbing side of that. I admit that due to some unfortunate piping error of some kind, it did slightly affect the water in the bath. The hot tap drips all the time, even when you turn it full on. But the main task did get accomplished. I did shift the loo to a position beside the bath where it now faces into the room. There was only one thing I neglected to take account of. Above the bath on that side, we've got one of those overhead clothes dryers that go up to the ceiling on a pulley, you see. So the consequence is, if ever you go to the loo on wash day, you get the feeling it's raining. But you do get the point that I'm making with this recital. For the non-handyman, far from the loo being the first place to start doing repairs, it's the reverse that's true. In fact, no one put it better than Tennyson did. 'Tis better to have lav done last.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, your vote has helped to produce a very remarkable result indeed, because Frank Muir and Dennis Norden tie with their stories, and the whole contest of this evening's My Word is itself a draw.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Schreier.